Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
People miss these people right here. They have family, they have big families. And there's someone out there.
Alaska State Troopers receive new information about a missing persons case in Fairbanks. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, October 14th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, Juneau residents whose homes were damaged in a landslide wonder what's next.
Honestly, it's hard to know where to start.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If you find yourself asking, what's next? The University of Alaska Anchorage can point you in the right direction. With over 100 fully accredited degree programs and certificates to choose from, plus resources to guide you through your academic experience, your future is in your hands. Whether you're starting over or taking your career to the next level, discover what's next at UAA. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Anchorage.
Ben Stevens, a former state Senate president and son of longtime Alaska U.S. Senator Ted Stevens, died last night at the age of 63. Stevens was hiking the Lost Lake Trail near Seward when he had a medical emergency, according to a statement from Alaska State Troopers. CPR was already being administered, and troopers requested a LifeMed helicopter to respond. Troopers say life-saving measures were unsuccessful and Stevens died on the trail. Stevens served as a state senator from his appointment in 2001 until he left office in 2005 during the Vico scandal. According to the Anchorage Daily News, Stevens was one of 6 state legislators whose offices were raided by the FBI in 2006 for suspicion of having taken bribes from oilfield services company Vico. 4 of those investigated were eventually convicted, but Stevens was never charged with a crime. Stevens returned to politics in July 2019, working as Governor Mike Dunleavy's chief of staff. In a statement this afternoon, Dunleavy said Stevens was a great friend of his who dedicated his life to making Alaska a better place. Dunleavy said, quote, "Everyone will remember Ben's continued commitment to our great state." Dunleavy offered his prayers to Stevens' wife, Elizabeth, and their children. In 2021, Stevens left the Dunleavy administration for a job as Vice President of External Affairs and Transportation at ConocoPhillips. In a short statement today, ConocoPhillips President Eric Isaacson said the entire company was deeply saddened by Stevens' death. Isaacson wrote, quote, "Ben was a valued leader at ConocoPhillips Alaska and leaves a significant legacy in the state of Alaska. Ben will be deeply missed not only by his family and colleagues, but by the broader Alaska community," end quote. One of Alaska's only providers of psychiatric treatment for children is under increased scrutiny after reports of patients escaping a hospital, write-ups by federal regulators for various deficiencies, and lawsuits alleging patients were sexually abused. North Star Behavioral Health operates 3 campuses in Anchorage and is the state's only provider of psychiatric care for children under the age of 12. It's also often the only in-state option for families or state caseworkers trying to find residential care for a child suffering from an acute mental health crisis. But some advocates for North Star's patients have been asking whether the hospitals are meeting their obligation to protect and treat those children, many of whom have been put there by the State Office of Children's Services. The Anchorage Daily News has been looking into those questions, and the ADN's Michelle Theriault-Boots says her most recent reporting started with an escape in June from one of North Star's DeBar Road facilities.
A patient there hit a fire alarm, which unlocked the doors, and 4 young patients, all minors, fled the hospital and roamed around Anchorage for hours. By the time they were tracked down and returned by police, one of the patients was so intoxicated they had to be hospitalized at another hospital. And that was one of the incidents that brought the federal inspectors from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid to the hospital to do kind of an emergency look at the conditions there.
You mentioned this was one of the incidents that led to an investigation. What else did the investigation find?
Yeah, a few months before that, the federal investigators had come to North Star and documented what they found to be problems with the way the hospital was using seclusion as a tool for controlling patients. And seclusion is when basically you get locked in a room or you are you're put in a place where you cannot leave and you're alone. They also found incidents in which patients had assaulted other patients, sometimes causing injuries. And they faulted the hospital for, I think in one case, not letting the parents of the patient know that the patient had been assaulted. They also noted that there was a patient that had been there for, I think, over a month and hadn't really received any treatment, hadn't received, I think, even a single therapy session that they were supposed to, which is, you know, the whole point of the hospitalization is to receive those services.
So in the course of this investigation, what ended up happening with North Star and the federal regulators?
Yeah, usually the way it works is federal regulators come and they can kind of ding hospitals for things. But if it's a really serious situation, it's called immediate jeopardy. And the hospital has to fix problems that lead to what are considered immediate jeopardy situations right away. And in this case, I think there was just one immediate jeopardy situation and the hospital fixed it. When I asked the hospital for comment, they said that they were in, you know, as of September, they were in good standing with the federal regulators and they didn't have any, they weren't under what are called any plans of correction or any other sanctions at that time.
And I take it that North Star didn't really comment too much beyond that, right?
Yeah, North Star has said they're bound by, you know, strict patient privacy rules. And so they don't comment on anything that involves any incident that involves a specific patient, though they did for a subsequent story confirm to me that I think that their words were that the hospital had, quote, experienced elopements, which plain English means patients had escaped.
So we have a little window into what's going on in this place that we don't normally hear about, kind of the inner workings of a hospital like this. What are advocates like the group Facing Foster Care or folks with the Disability Law Center telling you about what this means about this hospital?
I think for many years, advocates, including former patients and families of former patients, have been saying some of the same things. They have complained about the quality of care. They have reported some of the same things the federal inspectors found, such as assaults, escapes, patients not receiving the care quality therapy that they're sent there for. What I've heard from speaking to some of those advocates is that this is sort of a validation to have the federal inspectors find the same problems.
So then what's the upshot here? I mean, is it just that we know now a little bit more about what's going on at this hospital? There aren't any big plans right now for the federal regulators to come in and change things there. So what's the upshot?
Well, I think most recently, you know, every time we publish a story about this, I hear from people. I hear from patients at North Star. I hear from families. Sometimes I hear from professionals and former employees or even current employees. And after publishing these first stories, I found that there had been a lawsuit filed just at the end of September by the family of a boy who says he was sexually abused there. While a patient at North Star by another patient. And, you know, days after that was filed, I heard from another family who said they pulled their son out just last month because they also allege was sexually abused there. So my most recent story was about two families who alleged that their children were sexually abused while patients at North Star. And that raised quite a few questions about North Star's ability to supervise its population and raise some troubling questions about that.
You know, I have to ask, I mean, what has North Star said, if anything, about those cases?
North Star said that they had followed all the appropriate reporting procedures and were working with police and communicating with families in those cases. And again, they said they couldn't say much more because of patient privacy rules.
That was Anchorage Daily News reporter Michelle Theriault-Boots. You can find her full stories about North Star Behavioral Health at ADN.com. Officials with Anchorage Mayor Dave Bronson's administration approved a contractor to spend millions on building an emergency homeless shelter without getting approval from the assembly. Public Works Director Lance Wilbur acknowledged the mistake at a work session. He said the city had given Roger Hickel Contracting the go-ahead to spend $4.9 million on the construction of a shelter and navigation center in East Anchorage.
The error on our part was that in a traditional construction contracting process, we should have gone to the assembly initially and asked to amend the Hickel contract.
Anchorage Municipal Code states that any city contract of more than $50,000 has to be approved by the assembly. The assembly was initially supposed to vote on the contract in September, but pushed the vote to October 25th after expressing concerns over rising costs. The cost estimate for the project has increased from just under $12 million to over $15 million, according to city officials. Assembly members expressed concerns over potential lawsuits from Hickel and any subcontractors that have been working on the navigation center if they don't approve the funding. Assembly Vice Chair Chris Constant requested a list of any potential subcontractors that could be affected.
We were told if funds aren't made available, this work that was done, we could get sued. So I am definitely interested in seeing a comprehensive list of who the subs are.
Officials with the mayor's office and the Municipal Department of Law declined to answer questions about the funding or potential lawsuits. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, firefighters in Petersburg make fire safety and fireproof suits a little less scary.
We try to encourage them to ask questions and to, you know, look up close to see that there's actually a firefighter inside the gear.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
NEA Alaska is a professional education association representing over 11,000 of Alaska's dedicated public school employees. Their members are united in their commitment to provide an excellent education for every student, regardless of background or zip code. Together, NEA Alaska members work with colleagues, parents, and their communities to build strong public schools that are productive, safe, and welcoming to all. Learn more at neaalaska.org. This message sponsored by NEA Alaska.
Landslides are a growing concern in Southeast Alaska. A recent destructive slide in downtown Juneau left homeowners and the community grappling with how to respond and who pays. KTOO's Claire Strempel reports.
For Jen Mitchum, the answer so far has been friends and kind strangers. A friend started an online fundraiser for Mitchum after a September storm sent trees through his living room. He wasn't home at the time. The online fund has raised about $50,000. It's two long, steep flights of metal grate stairs to get to what's left of his house.
These steps here no longer go up, as you can see, but that originally went up to the front entrance of my house.
It looks like sheer force of impact knocked the home off its foundations and down the hill.
Yeah, I've got one tree that kind of bullseyed right through that tiny window there into my living room, yeah.
The door hangs off its hinges, and a robin pecks around in the detritus of the living room. Scavenging bears scattered food wrappers from the kitchen. The washing machine is upended, and golden insulation sprays out of a ripped wall.
Honestly, it's hard to know where to start.
Mitchum just moved from a hotel to a temporary apartment. His insurance is paying for his stay. And after that?
It kind of depends on whether my insurance agrees to cover for the situation or not.
Mitchum says he thinks he'll rebuild, but he has some concerns about the location now. His home isn't a severe landslide hazard zone, according to city maps. City officials say fallen trees are what totaled his house. It's good news for Mitchum because he doesn't have landslide insurance. Many Juneau residents report that their mortgage brokers tell them they simply cannot get landslide insurance in Southeast Alaska anymore.
It is available, but it's been extremely hard to write.
Emil Mackey works for an insurance agency in Juneau. He says he gets an automatic rejection when he tries to write Juneau clients landslide insurance. He says that's because of the fatal and destructive landslides in the region. The 2015 slide in Sitka and 2020 slide in Haines changed how insurers view risk region-wide.
No matter where you are in Juneau, if you're within 1 mile of any historic landslide, which is anybody near a mountain, which is everybody in Juneau, yes, it takes basically a geo survey to get approved.
A geotechnical survey can cost thousands of dollars. Mackey says this latest landslide is likely to affect insurance too, and not just in Juneau.
I think it's actually going to affect the availability of landslide insurance throughout Alaska, because most insurance companies actually consider risks on a state level or a county level, and not necessarily on a city level.
Both of Carol Treem's homes are in landslide zones. The Juneau Assembly member is calling for the city to do a better job responding to landslides. And no, she does not have landslide insurance.
Just the risk factors are changing so quickly.
Treem says 20 years ago, risk calculation was more static in Juneau. Residents could be expected to make their own risk assessments.
But that's changing. Climate change is changing that. I think that now that means that we have a role to play as a city government in helping people figure out what those risks are, how quickly they're changing.
Treem isn't an outlier. Roughly half of the downtown area is in a hazard zone for landslides or avalanches, according to the city's maps. After the landslide on Gastineau Avenue, the city cleared the road. Deputy City Manager Robert Barr says that's been its main job so far. But he says further involvement isn't in the playbook yet.
It's not that the community has decided to do nothing. It's that the community has decided to move forward in a more individualistic nature about thinking about risk in these sorts of emergency events.
In other words, as a community, Juneau hasn't made a plan for how the local government should be involved after a landslide destroys a home or a neighborhood. But Barr said that could change. The city will resume talks about the new hazard maps and what they mean next month. The city has considered buyouts in hazard zones before. That's where the city buys dangerous property so people don't continue living there. But Barr says the city hasn't considered buyouts for the homes damaged by this landslide, like Jim Mitchum's.
I would consider that.
Looking over the wreckage of his home, Mitchum says that's an offer he might take. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Claire Strempel.
There's been a development in the investigation of one of four cases of Alaska Native people who went missing in the Fairbanks area 2 years ago. Alaska State Troopers reported the break during a Thursday public meeting put on by the Fairbanks Native Association and the Tanana Chiefs Conference. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
The gathering at the Chief David Salmon Tribal Hall brought together local Native, city, and law enforcement representatives to update the community on the missing persons cases of Frank Manano, Debbie Nicktoon and Doran Sanford, who went missing in August 2020, and Willis Durendoff, who disappeared 3 months later in November 2020. Alaska State Trooper Interior Commander Captain Eric Spitzer reported receiving new information about one of the cases October 12th after talking to a group of seniors about the missing persons cases.
I can't disclose what happened exactly, but I will tell you this. When the meeting left, everybody left after the meeting, someone came up to me, and they provided me a tip.
Captain Spitzer said four troopers are following up on the lead.
I am bubbling over with things that I want to say to you right now, but in the interest of transparency, there's transparency, and then there's preserving the integrity of investigation. I will tell you this. In the near future, there's going to be some legal movement on a case. I can't tell you which case, but I'm telling you that we are working on this. We are going to hold those people responsible who are accountable.
Law enforcement has in the past stated that there appears to be no connection between the four unresolved missing persons cases, so a break in one does not indicate progress toward resolving the others. Spitzer also highlighted policies and tools aimed at improving missing persons case response and investigation, including an anonymous online AK tips window on the trooper webpage, which allows information to be shared and troopers to ask questions without knowing who they're communicating with.
Some people are suspicious about it. They're like, oh, it's not anonymous. They're going to find out who you are. It's an actual app that's designed. It's encrypted, so we can't swim upstream. We can't go back to find out who it is.
Several others who spoke also asked for the public's help, including Willis Durendoff's aunt, Rosie Simon, who referred to a poster of the four missing people.
People miss these people right here. They have family. They have big families. And there's someone out there everyone knows. They can't just disappear all one time with nothing, nobody knowing nothing.
New efforts to increase cooperation and transparency between the public, local government, law enforcement, the Fairbanks Native Association, and the Tanana Chiefs Conference were stressed by several speakers. The focus includes investigation of existing cases and more proactive action on new ones. TCC Chief and Chair Brian Ridley said the Interior Tribal Service Organization's VPSO program has received special designation from the state.
Where we can initiate searches in the Fairbanks North Star Borough when a tribal member goes missing. This allows for families to begin searching for a missing person immediately and for a missing person's report to be officially filed as soon as the person goes missing.
TCC and FNA are crafting a memorandum of understanding about how they'll work together on the issue. FNA Justice Director Shirley Lee emphasized the importance of cross-community and agency unity.
And I'm so hopeful about the work we're about to do jointly with TCC, improving our working relationship with FPD and the troopers and the new mayor.
Lee said FNA and TCC will continue to hold meetings every 3 months to update the public on missing and murdered Indigenous persons cases. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The IBEW is the union of skilled hands and generous hearts, hardworking people on the job and off. It's the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, the IBEW. This message sponsored by the IBEW Local 1547. If you are a hunter, birder, or outdoor enthusiast, the U.S. Geological Survey is asking for help tracking the bird populations in Alaska. The USGS manages a nationwide bird banding program, and every year, thousands of birds are marked with small, numbered leg bands. If you see, find, or harvest a banded bird, please report the band number online at reportband.gov. The information provided will help inform how bird populations may be changing. This message sponsored by the USGS Alaska Science Center.
Newly elected Bethel City Council members were sworn into their roles on Tuesday. The new council voted to create an amnesty program for certain business owners who owe sales tax to the city. KYUK's Nina Kravinsky reports.
The new city council voted 4-3 to create an amnesty program for certain business owners who owe the city unpaid sales taxes. That program will only apply to penalties and interest on unpaid sales taxes. Those who qualify for the program will still owe the taxes themselves. The program will be available for those who owe sales taxes between October 1, 2019 and October 1st of this year. The new program aims to get more business owners in compliance. Councilmember Beth Hessler authored the proposal. She's one of the business owners who found out recently she owed sales taxes to the city on a duplex she owns. She rents part of it out. The new ordinance would not apply to city council members. Hessler says not everyone who owes the city unpaid sales taxes is dodging them intentionally.
With the number of people that are being surprised with how the code actually is, I thought that it was fair to give an opportunity to forgive penalties.
This comes after a new city finance director started cracking down on businesses that haven't been paying the city the sales taxes they collect. Dwayne Wright has been more aggressive than past directors in auditing businesses suspected of not paying the city sales tax. Wright says the penalties can be as much as 3 or 4 times the amount of taxes businesses owe. He estimates the city could be leaving millions of dollars in just unpaid sales tax revenue on the table, not including those fees. Wright says he thinks, optimistically, only about 20% of local business owners have been paying sales taxes to the city. He says he's been having trouble getting business owners to respond to his push to collect that revenue.
There's a lot of money that's not being paid. And the general attitude, if they do communicate, is, you know, very adversarial.
Batchelor, one of the new council members, voted against the ordinance last night. He doesn't want business owners who have been ignoring the new finance director's request for compliance to be able to apply for the amnesty program.
Any of these people that have been stonewalling the department, they should not be capable of getting any amnesty because they are effectively saying, we're not participating. We're going to wait until something changes.
The new ordinance excludes business owners who are in the process of negotiating a compromise or settlement agreement regarding unpaid taxes. They're not eligible for the amnesty program. In Bethel, I'm Nina Kravinsky.
If a kid encounters firefighters in an emergency, their fire-resistant suits can seem scary. So every year, the Petersburg Fire Department visits classrooms to teach kids about fire safety and to show off those cool outfits. KFSK's Rachel Cassandra has more.
All the kindergartners in Aaron Willis's class are sitting crisscross applesauce on the carpet. They just finished watching a cartoon about fire safety. In the video, animals safely escape from a house fire.
At the firehouse, firefighters always stay ready to fight fires night and day.
Today, three firefighters are joining the class to talk about fire safety. Bjorn Stolpe starts putting on his firefighting uniform, piece by piece. Fire Marshal Ryan Weldy tells the class about the gear.
You see how I've got buttons and Velcro, and that's all sealed up really good, so nothing gets inside the coat.
Stolpe puts on his self-contained breathing apparatus.
And that's a backpack, just like a normal backpack, but it has an air cylinder on it with some hoses so we can get fresh air and breathe fresh air and smoke.
Dave Berg has been with the department since the mid-1980s. He says seeing a firefighter for the first time in an emergency can be extra scary.
To kids, that can be a real traumatizing situation. So we try to encourage them to ask questions and to, you know, look up close to see that there's actually a firefighter inside the gear.
In the classroom, Weldy helps the kids get used to the breathing apparatus.
Does it kind of sound like Darth Vader? Anybody know what Darth Vader is? Yeah, that funny breathing.
The firefighters explain that kids might see them moving around on the ground during an emergency. Stolpe starts crawling towards the kids, army style. The kindergartners scoot away to avoid him. Some of them look afraid and others are playing. The firefighters say the same thing might happen if there's a fire. Weldy tells the kids they shouldn't move away.
Don't hide from firefighters. We're there to help.
Yeah.
Then there's the very popular question and answer time with the firefighters. Well, maybe not questions exactly, but lots of kids want to share. Hayden McKay has an idea.
If there's a fireman and his house gets on fire, he can just put his outfit on if he's in the right, if there's not a fire in the room.
Weldy answers.
Yes and no, but we keep this at the fire station is where we keep this stuff and we get dressed in the fire station.
As the firefighters leave, Mrs. Willis rounds up the kids for circle time. Berg says the department also sees this week as a way for kids to make sure their families are prepared for fires.
You know, this is a good time of year that we remind the kids to change their batteries on their smoke detector, to go over fire safety plans with their parents.
Petersburg Fire Department's Learn Not to Burn program is part of National Fire Week. Firefighters and volunteers visit all grades in the elementary and middle schools. In Petersburg, I'm Rachel Cassandra.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Riley Board in Kenai, Wesley Early in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Claire Strempel in Juneau, Nina Kravinsky in Bethel, and Rachel Cassandra in Petersburg. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Tobin Shelby. Katie Anastas is our producer. I'm Casey Grove. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. Monies generated through estate and deferred gifts enable public radio to provide our listeners, you, with the level of programming excellence you've come to expect. It may also reduce income and estate taxes. Consult your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.